Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And a very important matter today. We're going to be speaking with Ann Garrison. She's a journalist, a Black Agenda Report contributing editor. And also she's with the San Francisco Bay View, Black Star News, Counterpunch, Pambacusa, and of course, hey, KPFA, Berkeley. I always say Berkeley.
And Pacifica. Yeah. Let me plug the new show. I work now on an hour that is on Pacifica nationally. It's at different times during the week, but it is broadcast on most of the stations and some of the affiliates. That's called COVID, Race, and Democracy.
And by the way, I'm going to just say at the top, and you're a contributor to Black Agenda Report and the Taylor Report, CIUT, all the listeners very much pained at the loss of the great Glenn Ford, who was a terrific journalist and a steadfast advocate of Black liberation and Pan-Africanism, and just a tremendous loss. But that Black Agenda Report is particularly timely for the interview we want to do with you, because I know he took a special interest in the Horn of Africa. He'd written about Eritrea, which is not done very frequently in American journalism, left, right, or center. Anyway, welcome to the show, Ann.
Thank you. And regarding Eritrea, Glenn Ford and the Black Agenda Report were Eritrea's only friend for many years. I think it was over 10 years when the U.S. and EU had it in their targets, were punishing it with censure, sanctions, and a massive disinformation campaign. And I think this is largely because they have an alternative economic model. Some call them the Cuba of Africa. I don't know how true that is, but they definitely have an alternative economic model. They were refusing to cooperate with AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command, and they would not agree to Western IMF and World Bank debt servitude.
Yeah. So readers of the Black Agenda Report, in a way, are a little bit in advance in terms of comprehending the situation in Ethiopia, and no doubt Eritrea will come up in our discussion. I guess, first of all, Anne, I want to know, we read and see in mainstream media that there is a armed struggle going on between the government of Ethiopia and a group called the TPLF, the Tigrayan armed group. Whether they represent Tigray or not has not been demonstrated to me. But at any rate, it's becoming an international issue, particularly because of the noise coming out of Western European capitals, but primarily the United States. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us how this, exactly, your view, how did this unfold? How did it start?
Well, the TPLF attacked a federal army base, a federal Ethiopian army base in Tigray province on November 3rd in the middle of the night. And of course, the Ethiopian army responded. What national army would not respond to an attack on one of its federal army bases? The fighting in Tigray went on until at some point in June. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed withdrew and declared a unilateral ceasefire. He said, this is an important time. Most of these people are farmers, and if you don't plant, you don't eat. And this is a time when people have to plant. What the Tigrayans said was that the Ethiopian National Defense Force was defeated in Tigray. And there were various interpretations of that, depending on which side of the argument you were on. But however that actually came down, the TPLF were the aggressors in the war. And as one of the judges in the Nuremberg trial said, the aggressor, the party who starts a war, yes, is responsible for the accumulated evil of the whole.
Yes. That, by the way, that should echo for Americans. That shots were fired by the slave owners, and it was clearly the initiation by an organization intending to break up a country. And of course, that's the view, I believe, of the Ethiopian government about this political leadership of the TPLF.
But, exactly. Wait, with regard to that, Trump's Undersecretary of State for African Affairs actually expressed outrage about that, compared it to the Confederacy firing on Fort Sumter. And then he criticized the TPLF for firing missiles into Eritrea at its capital, Asmara, and bringing Eritrea into the war. Later, he became very negative about Eritrean troops being in Ethiopia, in Tigray, but that's what he said at the beginning.
And, you know, on that matter of, I'm glad you raised the fact that They not only did they fire on the army of Ethiopia, but they did fire on a neighboring country, Eritrea. I suppose they were looking, one could speculate that they were hoping for a wider war to create an possibility of bringing in outside forces.
That's what the ambassador Tibor Nagy said, that they were trying to internationalize the conflict because, you know, I don't know if they thought that would bring in the U.S. because the U.S. has longstanding antipathy with Eritrea. But that did internationalize the conflict, and Eritrea took the brunt of the burden. Shortly thereafter, everyone forgot about the media, the Western media, and U.S. officials forgot about that aggressive act by the TPLF firing missiles into Eritrea and started blaming the Eritrean troops for being in Tigray. And there's also one issue there is a disputed region on the border of Tigray and Eritrea. I should say Ethiopia and Eritrea, because Tigray is part of Ethiopia. But it seems to me like Tigray was the primary aggressor in the long-running conflict between Ethiopia and Eritrea that Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed negotiated an end to when he came to power in 2018. But there's a disputed territory. It's in the desert. It's a small town of Badme, and it's not quite clear why it's so important. Maybe some resources there. I don't know. But an international boundary commission drew official boundaries after a ceasefire and said that Badme was part of Eritrea. But Ethiopia, meaning in this case the TPLF, never accepted that, and they occupied the territory that the Boundary Commission had said was part of Eritrea.
We're speaking to Ann Garrison, Black Agenda Report, KPFA, Pacifica. And it's very interesting how the West has characterized the government in Ethiopia. It's a big country, 112 million people. The prime minister came into office, I guess, 2-3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, everyone agreed that what an improvement he made and how promising the situation was going to be in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And now they've had to flip-flop and turn him into the devil, which, by the way, they seem to be succeeding at quite efficiently. But the TPLF, there seems to be a consensus, and I don't even see the New York Times and others arguing about this, that prior to his becoming the prime minister, the entire country of 112 million people was led by Tigrayans who represent less than 6% of the population of all of Ethiopia.
That's true. It was called the Ethiopian something or other coalition, but it was in fact dominated brutally by the TPLF.
For 30 years?
For 27. And yeah, almost 30. They don't refer to that much anymore because now the Western press want to portray Tigrayans as victims and the TPLF as victims, even though the TPLF ruled Ethiopia brutally for 27 years and started this war. Whenever Samantha Power starts wailing about genocide and cites Rwanda, Yugoslavia, and Syria, you know that that country, the country that that is directed at, is in trouble.
It has a target on its back.
Yeah.
We should bring in, again, the vocabulary you're pointing out, that Secretary of State Blinken, of course, Samantha Power, and their acolytes, people work for them, are all starting to use words like, Blinken said, ethnic cleansing.
Yes.
And Samantha Power said the prime minister is using rhetoric which have genocidal consequences because he referred to the TPLF as a weed. Well, an armed group that wages a terror attack on you, the word is criminal. It could be murder. I don't know. What nice word could he choose? But you must be struck by this. Certainly I am. I hear echoes of her previous work. All this backup idea of humanitarian intervention. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. Samantha Power has built her career on her interpretation of Rwanda, which you and I both know is radically wrong, the opposite of what happened. And whenever the U.S. wants to go in someplace and create chaos and destroy any resistance to the U.S. empire, It starts talking about genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and talking about the need for a humanitarian intervention, what you there in Canada, or at least Romeo Dallaire, call will to intervene. And these have exactly the opposite effect. They create chaos like that in Libya, Syria. They're about breaking down countries often that are not only resistant, but particularly powerful. Well, Burundi's an exception to that. Burundi was like David and Goliath in 2015, and it's not a hugely powerful country. But Ethiopia was the fastest growing, and so far as I know, still is the fastest growing economy in Africa. Mm-hmm. And if it's able to build, well, it has built, if its Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is not attacked and damaged, as people have worried that it may be by Sudan and with Egypt behind it, then it will electrify the whole country. It will produce so much electricity that Ethiopia will be able to sell electricity to its neighbors. So that will bring electricity to a majority subsistence farming population.
A country of 112 million becoming independent and worse from the American point of view, prosperous. What could be worse than the American point of view?
And Samantha Power, the result of what she does is often ethnic conflict and break. Oh, Yugoslavia. We didn't mention Yugoslavia. Yeah. She loves to cite Yugoslavia, which was broken up into many pieces and which was a very powerful country in Europe.
I'm glad you raised that because already rather clever disinformation is being spun off this strategy, because I noticed a woman called the Baroness Amika Hellick, who is... she's in the House of Lords. So Politico published an article by her saying, oh, I see another Yugoslavia coming because the leaders of Ethiopia speak the Tigrayan leaders in these loaded terms, which is nonsense, by the way, on the face of it. It is nonsense. Nobody used the language she's suggesting. But here she is in the House of Lords, the Baroness, and Politico is publishing her to make the case against the government of Ethiopia, which is a democratic government. Prime Minister very recently elected. So, you know, I don't understand why. Again, we used to have something called the left or progressive journals. That article should have been shot down immediately for what it was. It's kind of a trick.
Yeah, I have followed many of the waves of assault against the internationalist left that we knew in the late 60s, early 70s. Oh, of course, began with COINTELPRO, crushing movements like the Black Panthers and the Young Lords and the women's movement, even the women's movement at the time. Recently, since the Darfur issue and the Save Darfur campaign, all of these college students have been organized into groups that claim they want to stop genocide and mass atrocities. And
yes,
people like George Clooney and John Pendergast and Ben Affleck go and speak to them. And sometimes these young people are given jobs. You know, they're looking for quote unquote meaningful work right after college. And they sign up for one of these organizations that's supposed to be stopping. Yes, yes. And so, you know, they really made an attempt to recruit the student population into this whole responsibility to protect, will to intervene project.
Which creates havoc wherever it goes.
Yeah.
We're speaking to Ann Garrison. Articles appear on this subject of Black Agenda Report, and of course, been broadcasting on KPFA about this conflict in Ethiopia, which every day brings a new story of possible involvement of another state. I noticed Sudan is now been pushed to the front as a government to pick a fight with Ethiopia. And I have to point out, for me, it's like watching an old film, and I notice the same character. Because they have a story out of Sudan that there have been bodies found in a river. And of course, the bodies are now in Sudan. The bodies are found by Tigrayans. And then it's reported that they must have been killed by the Ethiopians in a most brutal way. So I remember vividly, and I urge people to read Judy Reaver, her book,
yes,
Rwanda, the same story of bodies going down a river, landing in a neighboring country, in this case, Uganda, an ally of Paul Kagame's. And then it becomes an international sensation as it cries that everybody said, do something. As Judy Reaver demonstrated in detail with witnesses, those bodies were actually victims of Paul Kagame's RPF.
The Tutsi army, and they were Hutus floating into Uganda.
Now I'm supposed to believe that when they find bodies in Sudan, and then I must, that automatically means a genocide is going on inside Tigray territory of Ethiopia. But I don't know if you followed, I found it so fascinating. They quoted five or six people in Reuters, Associated Press. Then they came to the Red Cross, and the Red Cross said they saw one body and they couldn't identify or know. And they made no commitment at all as to who might have been the source of the death of the body. And then the Red Cross said they saw two apparently graves. Oh, they were smart enough to say, because unless you dig it up, you don't know if it's a grave. But at any rate, so the Red Cross saw one body, but the international media is going with a story of bodies, bodies, bodies.
Right.
How terrible it must be.
Right. And they tried to say that they were Tigrayan bodies because they had some kind of ethnic markings. But I want to go back to Rwanda for just a minute. One thing that was preposterous about that story that Tutsis had been killed and went floating down the river into Uganda was that Paul Kagame's Tutsi army was in control of that territory
at
the time. Now, a lot of these things cannot be determined until serious investigations are done later, if they can ever be determined. But the original Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International reports were as flawed as their reports often can be. Often they were based on investigators on the phone in Nairobi, calling people in Ethiopia, in Tigray. And there's quite a dispute about one of the massacres, Maikadra, where both sides say that those were their people who were killed. And the West wants to say that the Tigrayans were the victims, just like it's determined to say that Tutsis were the only victims in Rwanda. Paul Kagame has these macabre museums full of bones that have become tourist attractions, especially in Kigali. Yes. And those bones don't have Tutsi and Hutu stamped on them. Well, they don't have Tutsi. They're supposed to be all Tutsi bones, but they're not stamped in any way that proves that. And Samantha Bauer will go into that museum and say, oh, wow, I just saw the enormous evidence of Tutsi genocide in Rwanda.
Yeah, she's a classic sad face. She loves to be seen weeping. That's Samantha's. But when she weeps, you know that she's about to attack you.
Exactly. And Rwandan Hutu people who want those bones buried because they believe that a lot of them are the remains of their families.
Well, they deserve human burials. By the way, Bishop Tutu, that when he visited Rwanda, the first thing he said is, these bones deserve a proper burial.
Burial, exactly.
And he didn't understand he was stumbling into highly politicized territory, but he, after all, he is a bishop. He knows what you're supposed to do with a body. You don't put it on display because there is human dignity to be mentioned in the family.
Absolutely.
And respect. And the body did not vote to be put on a show. And so,
exactly.
I'm glad I raise it because once again, when you hear a story that is so similar to a previous story and the person telling you the story is the one who told you the first one.
Yes.
Everybody's alarms should go off. I don't think I'll believe that. And that's why I threw in the point about the Red Cross. The Red Cross, bless their heart, they said, this is what we saw. We saw one body.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard that. You know, another story that we've heard before is the humanitarian corridor. Rick Sterling wrote a piece in the LA Progressive this week about the humanitarian corridor issue in Syria from Turkey into Idlib province. And he said that's province controlled by the Islamic fundamentalist jihadi terrorists who have been representing the U.S. in Syria all along. Mm-hmm. I think that at the UN Security Council, Russia agreed not to veto that. They considered vetoing it and didn't veto it. But here we go again with the humanitarian corridor. And that's the main issue that the West has been pushing, saying that Ethiopia is not allowing the humanitarian corridor and there's famine in Tigray. I saw the spokesperson, I think her name is Belaine Seyoum, the spokesperson for the president, speak at a press conference in which she said, those are our people, the Tigrayan people are Ethiopians, and we are sending relief in there. We are sending, I believe she said, 60% And we are allowing these other convoys in. However, there have been instances where humanitarian convoys were found to be transporting arms. So they have checkpoints to make sure that that's not happening. And I think most any nation in this situation would do that.
Well, I think this is coming up more and more often. We see it in Syria, as you referred to, and elsewhere. It's almost like a game of trumping your opponent. And so the most important issue here, and that's, by the way, this is in line of the work of the, I'm thinking of Black Agenda report over the year. Sovereignty for African countries is as sacred as the sovereignty of Great Britain or France or the United States. You don't get to go across the border because you've got an italicized word says humanitarian. You're dealing with a sovereign government.
Well, I learned something recently in an interview with Francis Boyle, the expert in humanitarian law, something that I hadn't known. He said that if the UN Security Council can agree that there is a genocide or something on that scale of horror taking place, then they can agree to create, of course, a multilateral force, not a US force, not a NATO force, a multilateral force. And
yes,
I hadn't realized that. But of course, in this instance, the UNSC has been divided just as it was on Syria and Burundi, with Russia and China refusing to vote even for the initial step, which is censure. First, it's censure, then sanctions. And if that hasn't satisfied Samantha Power and her ilk, then they will call for military intervention, or they'll just do it themselves. Of course, the U.S. does whatever it wants. It'll go try to get UNSC approval. If it doesn't, it'll get into a snit and start bombing itself.
Yeah, no, it's a very dangerous, extremely dangerous, actually, issue, this matter of when there might be a legal basis established. And the U.S. has been fudging that more and more over the years. They have argued, particularly over the humanitarian intervention, that if there's a finding, and they're looking for votes to get that done, if they could get a finding, they can independently of the Security Council then take action as a power capable of doing it. But they've not been able to get a finding. And they're not going to get one, because now we have drifted into a situation where China and Russia have begun to talk about what the game is really about. And they're not going to permit it.
Yeah, they're deadlocked now as they were during the Korean and Vietnam Wars. Again, of course, that didn't stop the U.S., but at least they're deadlocked. There was a time when Bill Clinton was able to go in and actually veto the one intervention, multilateral intervention that might have helped in Rwanda in 1994, because there wasn't enough resistance on the UN Security Council at that time. Actually, I learned something else interesting in my conversation with Francis Boyle. I asked him whether a veto could have kept the peacekeepers in Rwanda, and whether if there's an attempt to remove the peacekeepers from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, someone on the UN Security Council could veto that. And he said yes. So in 1994, someone could have vetoed the removal of the peacekeeping force, which was led, I believe, by Dallaire and, much more positively, Luc Marchal.
Yes. Yeah. It's one of those things which one you could say theoretically that was possible, but given the political alignment of the time, it wasn't going to happen. But let's point this out. We're hearing all this talk about international community, humanitarian aid. This is not coming from Africa. This is all coming from Europe.
It's condescending, it's patronizing, it's insincere, to say the least.
It bothers me that I read that the man in charge of humanitarian relief is one of the highest paid British civil servants, and he's a Knight of the Bath, a Knight Commander of the Bath in England. And then his prime deputy is also British and very well-to-do. When we talk about humanitarian relief, it has to have integrity to be respected by all parties. But you find a cabal of white Europeans.
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, I've been learning a bit more about this recently, too. It seems that the humanitarian agencies, the Office for Humanitarian Affairs at the UN and the UNHCR, the UN High Commission for Refugees. And there's another one I'm not thinking of, but another one that's supposed to have a humanitarian purpose. They are all dominated by the Western nations. China had some sort of commission that has to do with trade, and Russia has managed to place a leader on another UN commission, but the humanitarian commissions are all headed by Europeans. In fact, they seem to be allocated to different countries, like UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs is almost always a Brit.
Yes. And another kind of insidious aspect of it is actually the way I found those names. One of them is Martin Griffiths. He's a UN humanitarian chief. And then Mark Larcock, he's a humanitarian coordinator, a knight commander of the Bath, Order of the Bath. The way I found them was a headline told me that the United States and the UN were saying that Tigrayans were being starved. And I thought, no, the UN didn't say that. No, Mark Griffiths or Mark Larcock said that. It wasn't. United Nations did not give a press conference. The United Nations didn't say anything.
Yeah, the United Nations would be either the UN Security Council or the General Assembly. Those are the only entities that have the power to speak for the United Nations.
But the headlines do say UN.
I know. It's always like that.
And pretends it wants to be a peacemaker, but then has withdrawn its ambassador because Ethiopia rejected that. How can that be an excuse for this kind of...
That was kind of comical. He said he had offered to mediate between the TPLF and the Ethiopian government, and they turned down his offer, and that made him so angry. Usually an offer is an offer, not a demand.
Well, it's also, what other states encourage that? Yeah. I mean, there are other states, Kenya is not far away. There are many, but so why is some special privilege to the involvement of Sudan, which, by the way, is close to the action? There is a territorial dispute with Sudan. To me, it was comparable to asking Museveni of Uganda to participate in a discussion of the problems between the RPF and the government of Habyarimana. In other words, it's a loaded idea because he's a participant and an ally.
Yeah, exactly. And Sudan and Egypt and Ethiopia are in conflict about the Great Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. And that's another issue that Russia and China are backing Ethiopia on pretty much as well. And Kenya has recently signed some serious business contracts in Ethiopia, so it has more reason. There's been a lot of effort to get Kenya to be on Egypt and Sudan's side, and that's not working out. Egypt seemed to be clamoring for military action about the dam. And I'm told that there are actually Russian forces protecting the dam. The dam is heavily protected. It's militarily protected. It's protected, and Egypt has wanted to take military action, but they can't get any consensus for it. The African Union has tried to negotiate this issue of the dam for many years, and finally Ethiopia just said, okay, we're going to go ahead and build it. I talked to a hydrologist and civil engineer about this, and one thing he said was that people don't know whether consequence of global warming will mean more rain, more water in the Blue Nile River, and then the Nile, or less. That's how unpredictable it is. But one thing also that's important to understand about the dam is that it's the Blue Nile, which begins at Lake Tana in Ethiopia and flows across the Sudanese border and then into Egypt, where it becomes the Nile. And the White Nile from Uganda meets it in Sudan. And the Blue Nile, which flows from Ethiopia, is 75% of the water. And Egypt has been claiming that Britain deeded the water, all the water of the Nile, to them some long time ago, 1900 or something like that.
But by the way, all this is underlining just how serious this business is, because there's a stake for practically everyone in that part of that continent. And there are several countries there. All that water is becoming, and we're talking at the time of climate change, it's where there's nerves are on edge in these societies as to make guaranteeing possibility of development and agriculture and all that.
There's a disagreement about why Egypt is so upset about the dam. Some say that the dam and the electricity for the whole country and the ability to sell electricity to its neighbors will make Ethiopia a regional powerhouse, and Egypt doesn't want that kind of competition. That's the alternative to the theory that it's really about the water, which is Egypt and Sudan's claim. Mm-hmm. I think it's reasonable to expect some sort of agreements. Yes. About the water and what you do during drought conditions.
You would think a problem like the Tigray one would be exploited by states like Egypt or Sudan, hoping to drive a bargain with Ethiopia because they have an opportunity to play the Tigray card or join the West in giving a hard time to Ethiopia. This is a loaded geopolitical matter, this Ethiopia. Yeah.
And there are also various theories about why the U.S. is so upset about this. And several people have told me they're sure it's also because Ethiopia Prime Minister Abiy has signed something called the Tripartite Alliance with the presidents of Eritrea and Somalia. And they're charting an independent path that the U.S. can't tolerate. When Samantha Power gave this recent interview with NPR, she said Ethiopia used to be an anchor state in the Horn that was guaranteeing its stability. And it even sent peacekeepers all over Africa. And that meant, of course, that they sent peacekeepers wherever the U.S. wanted them to oversee its projects to create chaos and then manage it.
So actually, I'm really glad we've done this interview and talking about this, because it really shows the U.S. has so far been the big loser, because Ethiopia chose to become independent. Eritrea was delighted. And now they're all scrambling to find footing in a new world created by the rise of a democratic Ethiopia. Kind of interesting. And I would call it encouraging, actually.
I'll tell you one last thought. I know we should wrap it up here, but I really doubt that the U.S. or the U.S. and NATO would themselves bomb Ethiopia, because given Black Lives Matter, the sight of these white Western nations bombing a Black African country, not Libya, not Syria, would be too bad. So if we see an international escalation, it will be through proxy forces.
Let us hope you're right. Mussolini showed it wasn't a good idea to bomb his Abyssinia.
Right.
It cost him. Ann Garrison, thank you very, very much. And we look forward to talking again soon.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Phil. Talk to you later.